Good day and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call to Ms. Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling into Cigna's 2015 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team with Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be asked to participate in a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on today's seminar. And after this survey, you will have a chance to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eating-disorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled What's Brain Chemistry Got to Do with It? Again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eating-disorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled What's Brain Chemistry Got to Do with It? Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to sign up, you will receive email reminders for each month's presentation. Now, today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Marty Lerner. Dr. Lerner is the Executive Director of the Eating Disorder Program at Milestones in Recovery. Today he'll be sharing information with us on the addictive and psychological aspects of eating disorders. Welcome, Dr. Lerner.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. And a special thank you to my friends at Cigna for inviting me to participate on this, I guess, webinar. So hopefully you're able to pull up the slide presentation, and assuming that you have, I'm going to start to go through it, and we'll look at what we're going to be talking about today. And pretty much as the title describes, we're going to be looking at a specific aspect of eating disorders, and that has to do with two components. One is brain chemistry, or what physically accounts for eating disorders in some instances, if not most. And the other is looking at it through the prism or idea of it being an addictive disorder with respect to its nature. So if you look at part one, it kind of gives an overview of what we're going to be doing. And so really want to present the case for looking at an eating disorder as an addictive process, and we're going to go through a checklist presented by the American Psychiatric Association of what constitutes an addiction, albeit when this was considered by the American Psychiatric Association, it was being thought of in terms of substance dependencies such as alcohol, dependency, drug addiction, and the like. The other thing we're going to be focusing on is whether all of this can apply to the different flavors, if you will, of eating disorders. The restricting types like anorexia, the over-consuming types like bulimia, and binge eating disorder, which is, by the way, more recently included in and classified as a bona fide illness. And we're also going to look at the whole notion of how can food be addictive, and looking at it from the perspective of, I kind of look at it as a perfect storm, a blend of the nature of the person who can develop an eating disorder, but also the nature of certain substances which can contribute to that piece. For instance, not all children who eat sugary products become addicted or obese or develop an eating disorder as a result of that. It takes a combination of the predisposition and the nature of the person as well as the nature of the substance. And then lastly, we're going to go into a little bit of detail about brain chemistry and how that works and functions across all addictions, but specific also to eating disorders. What's the common ground? So if we go to the next slide, as I explain, the American Psychiatric Association got together and finally wanted to look at a a uniform set of criteria or symptoms to describe what a dependency or addiction is. And rather than look at it from drug addiction, alcohol dependency, compulsive gambling, if you will, bulimia, anorexia, binge eating, they look at it from the perspective of what do all these have in common. So I'm going to go through this a little bit quickly, but hopefully not so quick that it'll be confusing. The symptoms of addiction, this can apply to bulimia, anorexia, or binge eating disorder. One is tolerance, and tolerance simply means needing to do more of the same substance or needing to do more of the same behavior to get the same effect. So if someone were taking pain medication, for example, they would develop tolerance from the physical sense because they would need to be taking more and more of the medication in order to get pain relief. Well, likewise, someone with an eating disorder may find themselves having to overeat more frequently and more food in order to get the same effect that they were originally getting when they were overeating. And likewise, on the other end of the spectrum, if someone were dieting or restricting in the restricted type of eating disorder like anorexia, they may have said to themselves, well, if I can lose so-and-so weight and get to a certain number, then I'll stop and, you know, I'll feel okay. But the reality is, as we well know, that it's never enough. And so what happens is the person has to keep restricting or losing weight to gain the same effect that they originally were seeking. So that's what tolerance is. Withdrawal does not necessarily have to be all physical. Most of us are a little bit, indoctrinated to look at withdrawal as something rather dramatic. And the way it's portrayed in the media, you know, really reinforces that notion. The reality is the physical symptoms of withdrawal can be somewhat subtle, and they can vary from person to person. So any of you who are like myself that, you know, drink a couple of cups of coffee a day, especially in the morning, if you were to all of a sudden stop your intake of caffeine, I don't know that you would go rob a 7-Eleven or something of that sort, but certainly you would have a headache. You might not feel all that well, maybe have some difficulty concentrating, that sort of thing. And then the psychological effects in withdrawal are more, and we'll talk about this in a later slide, more about being deprived of the benefit or reward or pleasure from the substance or behavior. So again, withdrawal as it applies to an eating disorder might be someone entering the treatment phase that's restricting and is being asked to eat, and believe it or not, they may find the consumption of food as aversive or something that is painful for them, at least psychologically, and find that their withdrawal has to do with no longer being able to restrict or what are the consequences of refeeding. More so with bulimia and compulsive overeating, withdrawal can be specific to certain substances like sugar, as I mentioned, caffeine, or very refined processed foods, or more so psychologically, giving up or reframing from a major source of reward or comfort or sedation in the way of food. So you have tolerance withdrawal. The other is kind of self-explanatory, more for longer periods than intended. The other is unsuccessful effort to cut back or control. Anybody that's had experience with a loved one with an eating disorder, or if you can relate to this yourself, knows that efforts on the consumptive side have to do with diets and restricting, off again, on again, and with bulimia, trying to refrain from purging, regardless of the form, and attempting to restrict in order to do that, and so on and so forth. The bottom line being that the remission or effort is usually short-lived. I guess the best quote is, it's sort of like cigarette smoking. I've quit 1,000 times. Very difficult if it's an addictive process. Significant time to obtain or recover from effects. Now, mind you, this committee was thinking about alcohol abuse and drug abuse, but if you really think about it, this would apply across the board to all forms of eating disorders just by virtue of how much time, how much energy, how much money, and how much pain has been involved to sustain the behaviors. Decreased activities due to dependency. The best way to frame that is that these are all isolative diseases. Most people who have binge eating disorder, certainly with bulimia and also with anorexia, usually in the later stages, tend to want to be by themselves, do not eat in front of other people or are self-conscious about that, again, across the board, and tend to really isolate themselves from most of their social contacts. And then last, but certainly not least, is to continue the behaviors of the substance despite consequences. Excuse me. What's interesting about all of this is that per this committee from the American Psychiatric Association, one of the questions I would ask is, well, how many of these symptoms or criteria or what have you need to be met in order to define someone as having or diagnose someone as having an addictive relationship with either overeating or undereating or an eating disorder? And the answer, surprisingly, is only three. And when I polled patients at our treatment center, usually response is either six out of six, or at the very least, five out of six. Okay, so now with that as a basis of understanding a little bit of what we're going to be talking about, the questions that we're going to be looking at again are, how much of this is the nature of the substance or the behavior, and how much of this is about a predisposition or the personality or the structure of the person? And is it also dose dependent, or how amounts and for how long has the behavior gone on? Translation, you know, what's the difference between someone who goes on a diet and loses 10 or 15 pounds, you know, at the age of 18 or 28 or 38, and another person who begins that and then finds that they can't stop? So there's a nature of the person and, of course, the nature of the behavior to look at. And, of course, our topic is brain chemistry, and we want to look at how does this work, you know, in eating disorder patients. And we're going to be talking about something called the reward circuit and how that influences not only eating disorders, but how it also relates or is associated with other addictions. And then you can decide for yourselves whether this is a shoe that fits in terms of your own experience or experience with loved ones. We're also going to look at the substance, and there's a growing body of research that shows a predisposition among some folks towards being influenced by sugar, flour, really highly processed foods in a way that may be different than their non-afflicted peers. So that translation might be looked at as you know, some people have a reaction metabolically, psychologically, and otherwise to some of these products, almost like an allergy, and some people don't. But there's definite evidence that those that do can develop an eating disorder, and over time some of the disease processes that we see amongst a little bit older population with eating disorders, which is diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and such. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And lastly, I'm often asked, well, how can restricting, you know, be addictive too? That, I would say, is more the nature of the behavior than a substance. And we'll look at the brain chemistry and dynamics or mechanisms along with that. So we go to another section here. You'll see a slide that says part two, the physical aspect of addiction and brain chemistry. So we're going to be looking at what's the physical addiction with eating disorders. What's the research showing us? Are there, you know, advances, you know, that can clearly lend evidence to what were historically more theories? And again, I'll explain that and illustrate that in the next couple of slides. And also, as I said, what are the offending substances, particularly with bulimia and binge eating disorder, and the role of these substances? And then what about starvation or chronic dieting or compulsive exercising or making yourself sick to get rid of food? All of those have addictive elements as well, which we're going to be talking about. The next slide is getting into really explaining this in depth. So hopefully you can see this slide, but it's a comparison of the research that's been done in the past by using something called PET scans, which is proton-emitting, I won't get into the technical aspect of it, but it's sort of like an MRI or CAT scan. And in this particular case, we're able today to map and demonstrate concentrations of certain chemicals in the brain. And without going into a lot of detail, there are three primary chemicals in the brain that are called neurotransmitters. And they influence our appetite, our moods, our sex drive, a whole bunch of functions for us. But most notably, it is what's often referred to as the reward center of the brain. So if you look by way of demonstration on the first tier, you'll see cocaine, you'll see methamphetamine, below that alcohol and heroin. On the left side, you're looking at people that are normal controls, people that are not abusing or using those substances. And what you'll see in that column are red areas in the brain. And that's just simply showing a concentration of a chemical called dopamine. And I'll just tell you that dopamine is the feel-good chemical. It's the reward chemical. When someone abuses cocaine, their concentration initially of dopamine is threefold, what you're seeing in that, you know, in that slide. Unfortunately, one builds tolerance to that, and eventually it takes more of these substances to create more of the dopamine and to experience reward. So what you're looking on the right side is eventually what happens to someone who's abusing cocaine, alcohol, or other drugs is that their brain starts to assume that they don't need to regenerate this chemical because they're getting it from an outside source. So what ends up happening is when this person stops using cocaine, alcohol, heroin, methamphetamine, or what have you, they go through not only withdrawal, but it could take upwards for a year for their body to regenerate the concentration of this chemical. Translation, most people who have been abusing and or dependent on these substances are very depressed and find it very difficult in the early recovery stages to find any pleasure, reward, or are dealing with a great deal of anxiety and discomfort. So it goes beyond just withdrawal. It really puts them in a position where the healing process can take time in terms of regenerating the chemicals in the brain to bring them back to a normal mood state. Now let's talk about how this all applies to eating disorders. So if you look at the last 3 years, the PET scans and CAT scans started to look at, yes, cocaine, yes, alcohol, but if you see in the upper right slide, they started looking at eating disorders. And this particular slide, I just happen to know, this is someone with bulimia. And so what's happened with this person is if you look at the normal brain, you can see the red area, which is normal concentration of dopamine. So this person's moods are rather stable and normal, and for the most part, this person can experience pleasure and rewards from day-to-day normal activities. When you're looking at someone with an eating disorder over time, the only way they can accomplish that red area in the brain is by engaging, and again through tolerance, a great deal of binging and purging or exercising or whatever the addictive process is. So in the absence of doing that, what you're seeing on the right side is someone that is very uncomfortable. And that discomfort is noted in terms of a deficit or lack of a chemical in the brain called dopamine. Here's a quick aside. and again, not to be too technical, the role of most antidepressants, although they'll vary in terms of what chemical they may be concentrating on restoring, is to affect the concentration of either dopamine, serotonin, or another chemical called norepinephrine. What's important to know is not the names of the chemicals, but to know that antidepressants are a tool, not a magic bullet, to try and compensate for the damage done by either depression or addiction. And most people with addictions do suffer with depression, and this is why. However, many antidepressants will not work or will only partially work with people with an eating disorder and or any other addiction, because the effects of the eating disorder do not only affect the concentration of the chemical, but the structure of the brain that's able to make use of the chemical or receptors. The easiest way to understand this is the chemical is the key, and there are billions of these little keys, and then the receptors are like little locks, and you start to have deficits in the locks, so no matter how many keys you have or how much dopamine you have, it can't find the lock to go into until a lot of time passes and it can regenerate itself. And that can take months, if not years, for some people. If we go on to the next slide, another way of looking at this, and again, this is kind of looking at the tolerance piece, is you can see a cycle of declining dopamine receptors, those locks that we're talking about. And someone can begin, you know, by binge eating or compulsively overeating in this example. What they get from that is maybe feeling numbed or feeling sedated or feeling some kind of reward or, you know, pleasure response. But what quickly ensues, if it's repeated enough, are cravings. And then there's more binging, and then there's even less pleasure because you have to do more and more and more of the same behavior, stronger cravings, and the cycle begins. One way to look at this with all addictions, but particularly eating disorders, or at least I like to frame it this way, is whether it's restricting, whether it's over-consuming, it's never enough. I'm just going to go through this slide. I kind of put it in here, but I think it's relevant. In my experience, when people develop an eating disorder, particularly overconsumption ones like bulimia, compulsive overeating and whatnot, over the years, someone 18, 19, 20, if not treated properly into their 30s and 40s, will develop systemic diseases such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes and what have you. So it's sort of like looking at someone with alcohol dependency. In their late teens and early 20s, they're not suffering from liver disease as readily as there is a chronic or length of time that they've been abusing alcohol, and then it starts to take its toll. And again, when we look at the nature of the substance, we know that sugar, if you have enough of it and for a long enough period of time, is an addictive substance. That's more fact than fiction today. So if you look on the left, when you eat sugar, most of us like it, but if you keep eating it, it does have some addictive properties. And one of the things that happens is it spikes your insulin level, but it also spikes the level of dopamine. In other words, the feel-good chemical dopamine is released in the brain, along with insulin being released in the blood system in order to metabolize the sugar. But also the dopamine is released, which is why we feel good after, eating a lot of candy, ice cream, or, you know, a heavy meal. For someone that has an eating disorder, it's exponentially increased. So in the third piece of this little cycle, the blood sugar level, you know, will go up a lot. A lot of insulin is discharged from the pancreas or to take care of the glucose or the sugar, but what happens is a trampoline effect or rebounding effect, and all of a sudden the blood sugar goes up but very, very rapidly comes back down, which creates a cycle of eating and then getting hungry, eating again and getting hungry. I used to call that China syndrome, sort of the phenomenon of feeling hungry 10 minutes after you've had a lot of Chinese food. But basically, there's a physiological reaction that's happening that the more sugar or more high glycemic or junk foods that you eat, the more rapidly it gets absorbed and the more rapidly you're going to get hungry again and the less time in between eating. And then last on the slide, you see pretty much what I'm explaining. The hunger and cravings just increase. You end up either hypoglycemic or what's called insulin resistance, where your blood sugar can remain high or low, but the fact of the matter is that the insulin is no longer efficient at being able to lower your blood sugar, and then you develop a problem. So going on to the next slide, what we're looking at here is delineating the difference between someone that suffers from anorexia or a restricted type of eating disorder and someone who may suffer with an overconsumption type of an eating disorder like bulimia or COE is compulsive overeating. Now, this is a little bit interesting, and I'll try to explain it. This is more theory than fact. It's some of the research that's, you know, we're involved with at present, looking at anorexia versus other eating disorders. But let me just go through the differences, and then I'll explain why this may be. With anorexia, you will show elevated levels of dopamine after a meal, even if it's not a large meal. And with binge eating disorder or with purging, what you'll see is also elevated levels of dopamine, at least in the short run, and eventually a building of tolerance and destruction or not regeneration of receptors, and so on and so forth. Same thing with anorexia, but for a different reason. The restricting anorectic, although they'll experience elevated levels of dopamine, the research is showing us that a large contingent of people who develop anorexia really experience eating physiologically, not only psychologically, as unpleasant. So the reason for that is elevated levels of dopamine normally would make someone feel good. That feeling is interpreted or experienced as negative by someone or a contingent of people, not all, but many people with anorexia. I'm going to use an analogy that's a little bit of a stretch, but I hope it will help explain this. Some people can take a medicine, like a stimulant, and their reaction to it would be to become calm rather than stimulated and to be able to concentrate better. So if someone has an attention deficit disorder, their experience of taking a medication for that is completely different than someone who doesn't have that problem. Likewise, there's some people that experience a medication as pleasant and other people experience it as unpleasant. We don't know exactly why, but I think it has to do with how people have learned to experience different levels of excitement or different concentrations of this chemical. So back to a basic here, some anorectics, we don't know how many, experience increased levels of dopamine as anxiety rather than excitement, as something unpleasant rather than pleasant. Binge eaters will uniformly experience high levels of dopamine as rewarding and pleasant. There's a higher incidence with bulimia and compulsive overeating or overconsumption, much higher, of cross-addiction. So a lot of folks that suffer with binge eating, compulsive overeating, or bulimia have at least a predisposition or a higher risk, if not a history, of also abusing either alcohol or drugs or actually any behavior or substance that would sedate, fix, or enhance their feelings. In other words, the nature of the person may be addictive as well as the behavior or substance. With anorexia, it does occur, but it's with a much lower frequency. Okay, let's move on to, okay, we know what the problem is, or at least I'm proposing what part of the problem is. You know, what are things to consider in terms of the solution? And basically, there are two avenues to look at and two models to look at. And I'll just say that one size doesn't fit all when you look at individuals with eating disorders. So there's an addiction model, which we're talking about, and a blended model, and a psychiatric model. So we're talking about folks that would fit more into the addiction model, whereas there may be someone that would fit more into a medical or psychiatric model. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But the other consideration in treatment is the level of care and also what's the intensity of treatment. By that I mean, does someone need to be in a hospital environment with 24/7 nursing and medical support and kind of a lockdown type of a unit versus a residential setting that provides more support, a good amount of supervision and structure, but is not as intrusive or restrictive as a hospital setting. Then there are partial hospital settings and intensive outpatient levels of care where the intensity is similar to residential levels of care during the day, but patients go home at night and stay in their own environment except for 6 to 8 hours a day. And the intensive outpatient programs can be anywhere from 3 to 7 times a week, but are usually half-day programs. And again, someone is commuting from home and participating. And the lowest level of care, or least intrusive, is perhaps seeing a dietitian, you know, on a weekly basis and a therapist once or twice a week. The other consideration is whether someone has multiple issues. And that's not an uncommon occurrence. Most of the patients we see here at Milestones suffer with, you know, a primary problem with an eating disorder, be it anorexia, bulimia, or compulsive overeating, and about 80 to 90% also have a co-occurring mood disorder, usually depression or an anxiety disorder. And I would say about 40% of the folks that we see, at least here, also have a history or currently have been struggling with drug or alcohol abuse. So, and I want to delineate, there's a difference between use, abuse, and dependency. We tend to see people more in the range of abuse who have a propensity towards dependency but are switching back and forth, self-medicating with an eating disorder as well as maybe drugs and alcohol. And so it leads us to ask what we're really dealing with. The other consideration is whether the focus in treatment is on body weight as the end-all or whether the focus on treatment is really changing all the behavior in the relationship to food and body image, but not focusing or reinforcing someone weighing themselves every day and dictating a progress by way of what the number is on a scale. There's a subtle difference, but it's subtle but very significant. Most people with eating disorders are very preoccupied with a number on a scale, either not wanting to see or have anything to do with it, or measuring themselves multiple times a day because they're getting caught up in the number and their moods are completely dictated as to whether the scale moves to the left or the right and so on and so forth. So a consideration is whether that is adding to the problem or having someone maybe weigh and measure their food so that they're eating an adequate amount and not in denial about undereating, same with overeating, and not paying direct attention to body weight, which would take care of itself if someone is in over or under eating. So when you look at this in another frame, you'll see part three, emotional aspects of eating disorders. So what I wanted to also impart is that most eating disorders or people that we see at this level of care, residential, inpatient, partial levels of care, also suffer with mood disorders. And in the population of everybody that has an eating disorder, the statistics with mood disorders as a standalone or co-occurring issue is anywhere from 70-90%. I'll add to that that it is significant to find out whether the mood disorder predated came first and the eating disorder second. And the reason for that is some people are predisposed towards, chemically speaking, depression, and then stumble upon, you know, overeating or restricting as an antidote for that, and then become enamored and then addicted to compulsive dieting or compulsive eating, because in the beginning it sedates, fixes, or enhances their mood. In other words, food and dieting can become an antidepressant, albeit a very misguided and dangerous one. Substance abuse, as I noted, can be anywhere to 40 to 60% of the eating disorder population. There is a correlation between past trauma, or what's known as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and mostly overeating and bulimia, to some extent with anorexia, but in the population overall, 20 to 40%. Personality disorders, it's an often abused term. It doesn't have much meaning for me. It simply means that someone's nature of the person has an inclination to being either perfectionistic or very hot-tempered, kind of all or none in approach, either liking people or disliking them, but no shade of gray. So it could have to do with emotional maturity. It could have to do with rigidity, compulsivity, that sort of thing. And that's probably inherent to a distressed degree within about 20 to 40% of the population. And then lastly, in terms of cross-addiction, there's something called process or behavior addictions. And so they're not substances, but they can be compulsive behaviors, like compulsive spending, compulsive gambling, sex addiction or compulsivity with relationships, and so on and so forth. And as we mentioned, these are the levels of care in the next slide that we talked about, which is inpatient, residential, partial, intensive outpatient, and outpatient. We use, and what we're talking about in this webinar, so to speak, is a blended model of treatment. And it has some assumptions inherent with it. And I'm just going to go through it sort of briefly. One is we assume an eating disorder is part of an addictive process. It has physical, emotional, and sometimes spiritual components. Spirituality is an often misunderstood term, but basically it's purposefully confusing because it's a wide net to cast, and it really is another way of saying someone having a belief system that goes beyond just reliance on themselves and having some sense of purpose or identity that goes beyond self-preoccupation or obsession. A blended model also assumes that this is a disease that's a predisposition towards an eating disorder, and that it is lifelong. It has periods, no doubt, of prolonged remission, but it's often punctuated by relapses followed by continued recovery. So to me, in my experience, treatment is a process, not an event. And what that means basically is the expectation in treatment is to stabilize someone, but realize the recovery process is something that is more or less two steps forward and one back. I don't know it's like a switch where all of a sudden you've treated someone and they're cured. So relapse can be part of an addictive disease, and if you're not looking at it as an addiction, you may be talking about this in terms of cure, but I think that that's unrealistic. Probably the exception than the rule. Long-term remission, that's probable. It also may incorporate, I know we do, traditional therapies, something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or examining someone's beliefs or what they're telling themselves, their self-talk, nutritional therapies, eating whole food rather than junk food, working with a dietitian, having patients weigh and measure their food so that they're not insecure about overeating or undereating. We can employ psychiatric medications, particularly for anxiety or depression, which goes hand in hand with an eating disorder and is an important tool to at least consider. And also support groups in the community. We use a lot of 12-step, what's called 12-step or addictions-oriented support groups. There are several in the eating disorder community. There's Overeaters Anonymous, obviously for people that are compulsive overeaters or binge eaters. There is something called ABA, which is a 12-step program for people that suffer with anorexia and bulimia. And there are Food Addicts Anonymous. There's just a whole grouping of these support groups. The advantage is they're numerous and they're just about everywhere. And one benefit is that someone need not be dependent on the professional community in and of itself for support. I could probably spend hours talking about the benefits of support groups, but just know it's an integral part of the ongoing recovery process. And there are other community-based support groups. There's something called Smart Recovery, which is a more psychologically oriented, non-spiritual type of approach to addiction, eating disorders being included. I have a few more minutes left, so I just want to run through this, and then we can open things up to some questions. These are the treatment components that are used with a blended model. We use a structured food plan, which eliminates basically the offending substances, sugar, flour, for people that have more of an issue with bulimia and compulsive overeating. We use cognitive behavioral therapies and what we call harm reduction, which is reexamining what people are telling themselves, their self-talk, their belief system, that sort of approach. We use a model called constructive living, which is basically putting the responsibility for recovery with the patient, and with less emphasis on always having to insist on feeling comfortable and more emphasis on doing, as I like to say, the next right thing, despite how one might be feeling. So the focus is on action, not on fixing feelings as a condition of taking action. We treat multiple disorders at the same time. Although everybody here has an eating disorder, if they have issues with chemical abuse or dependency or a mood disorder, we want to treat that as well. As mentioned, we make great use of community-based support groups. We do use medication when it's indicated. We try to use evidence-based treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy, harm reduction, something called DBT, and so on. And we individualize family therapy. One size doesn't fit all in the family system, and daily living skills. I'm going to speed this up and say that the structured food plan, because this often is asked, it can be a source of confusion. It's a food plan that's prescribed by a registered dietitian that's familiar with eating disorders and this model. It often, as I mentioned, involves weighing and measuring portions so that people do not overestimate or underestimate the amounts of food that have been prescribed on their food plans. People with eating disorders, whether they're small, medium, or large, have a tendency to overestimate or underestimate how much they're eating. Better that they weigh and measure amounts of food than weigh and measure their body every day. The body will take care of itself if someone isn't under or overeating. We like to schedule people to eat in a rhythm of time, so there's not too much time in between meals. So we advocate anywhere from 3 to 5 times daily, so 3 meals, 2 snacks if you want to look at it that way. We do eliminate junk food. We focus on a food plan, not a diet. Difference is a diet's temporary. A food plan, although it can be adjusted, is looking at a lifestyle change. And we discourage patients, again, from focusing on weight. My advice is that they throw away their scales. I'm going to skip through this essential elements, but I use an acronym called SERF. It stands for Spirituality, Exercise, Rest, and Food Plan. And basically, those are the 4 pillars or elements to successful treatment. Obviously, with exercise, rest, food plan, and spirituality, it has to do with a balance, because most people with eating disorders can over-exercise or under-exercise, get too much rest or do too much activity, be too perfectionistic with a food plan, and so on and so forth. So looking at common sense prescriptions for spirituality, exercise, and rest. And food plan is an essential or integral part of what we do here. And timing is good. I'm about wrapping up. The resources, if you like, of course, you can call us at that 800 number, but also we have open support groups in the Pennsylvania, New York, Florida, and more recently in the Washington, Richmond area. And they're open to anyone who wants to come that is interested or has a family member with an eating disorder. And, of course, it's free and open. Other support groups that are throughout the country are Anorexics and Bulimics Anonymous, Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorder Groups out of Chicago, and a website which is called edreferral.com, which lists lots of therapists and resources in the eating disorders community. And last is a book that I had written, which is free. You can download it at iBooks if you have an iPad. It's called A Guide to Eating Disorder Recovery and goes through much of what we talked about today. And that's free also. You can download it if you ask me for it by just emailing me and asking for the book. And that's my commercial, Treating Eating Disorders. So I want to thank everybody for paying attention and letting me discuss our approach here and what the science is. And I'm going to turn this back over to our moderators from Cigna, and they're going to discuss a survey with you, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions and discussion.
To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Question number one. This session provided me with a better understanding of aspects of addiction. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. And we'll pause for a moment. And we'll move to our next survey question. This session educated me on the blended treatment model approach. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. And we'll pause for a moment. And we'll move to survey question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. And we'll pause for a moment. And we'll move to survey question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 2 for agree, and star 2 for disagree. And we'll pause for a moment. And we'll move to survey question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, for I am a health professional. And star 4, for other. And that does conclude our polling survey questions. And if you'd like to signal for a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. And at that point, please state your name before posing your question. Once again, that's star 1 to signal for a question. And again, as a reminder, that's star 1 to be placed in the queue. And we'll take our first question.
Hi, my name is Diana, and I wanted to thank you for this program today. I think it was a wonderful overview of your treatment program. I had an eating disorder when I was in my early teens and early 20s. I'm now 51, I've been recovered. I consider myself fully recovered for 20 years. My treatment program was very similar to what you're doing here. And I just want to say I think your treatment program is right on target for what you need to do to get people the help they need. The only thing I disagree with is that I don't think it necessarily has to be a lifelong struggle because I consider myself completely free. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't refute that at all. Remission can be lifelong. So what I would say is, you know, for you, the fact that you've had an eating disorder and you're past, from a medical model, past 5 years of being in remission, some people talk in terms of cure, and some people, like myself, talk in terms of remission. It's a little bit of semantics, but I totally, you know, appreciate what you're saying. You don't need to think of yourself as eating disordered, and you can use the word recovered as opposed to recovering, which is part of the language that's used in the recovering or recovered community.
Right. Where is your treatment located? I know you said you're in Pennsylvania. What part of Pennsylvania?
No, we're in South Florida.
Oh, okay.
Although I go to Pennsylvania to see people that have been through the program, as well as New York and a bunch of other places. But no,
yeah, my treatment program, I was in the hospital twice. The latest one was 1990, and the approach was exactly what you're doing at your facility. I mean, exactly.
I don't want to date myself, but I've been doing this for 35 years, and so I won't name hospitals, but there were several that I have worked with that had this model, and the model kind of disappeared for a little while and is starting to come back with the research being able to look at this from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with a woman named Dr. Ruth Kane?
No.
Are you familiar with that name? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll move to our next question.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Al, and I'm the father of a currently 21-year-old who is struggling. And I felt as though your presentation was specifically referring to my daughter and her situation. It's uncanny how many points you made where it's as if my daughter were sitting in your office. So at this point, I can tell you that she has she is currently a junior in college, and she took last spring semester off because it was the recommendation of all of the then current professionals that she go into a residential care. So she was out of school for the 6 weeks for residential care. And then subsequent to that, she was in the what I guess we refer to as IOP for the final 2 weeks. So 8 weeks total before she returned to campus. She is still struggling. Here we are 11 months or so removed. And while I think she is poised for success, she is still struggling. And I don't want to discount the care that she's getting now. I believe she's getting really good care. But again, when I hear your presentation, I can't help but feel, holy smokes, there it is. So I'm encouraged that quite possibly we could move on to, you know, when I hear that 20 years remission is possible, I start to get emotional.
Yeah, I mean, look, it can be misleading, and I know it's not a popular view to tell someone, especially a parent, that it's a lifelong illness, but that doesn't mean that someone is ill lifelong. Let me give you an analogy, and I'll just throw this out for point of making a point. I'm an ex-smoker for 27 years, and, you know, I have a higher probability if I pick up a cigarette of being re-addicted very quickly than someone who's never smoked before. So I don't plan on doing that, but I think it's important for me not to forget that I had an addiction, if you want to look at it that way, to tobacco. And I know that sounds like a very simplistic analogy, but the reason that's important, and maybe more important for someone with an eating disorder, is because if you adopt the notion that you're cured in that sense, you could be tempted to go on a diet again, or you could be tempted to, engage in some kind of high-risk behavior or what have you,
sure,
and find yourself, back to square one and say, how did this happen again? So I hope
right.
that clarifies what I'm saying.
It absolutely does, and I wasn't so much naive as I was just encouraged that if there is one victory out there, even if we'll call it just remission, that there is hope, because I have seen firsthand some struggles, including ideations, that I never in my wildest dreams did I see that coming.
I know. It's, I could sit here and talk all day, but, you have an experience, and usually when you look at the content of what I'm talking about, it either resonates totally with people or it doesn't. And the reason it resonates is because someone's fitting into that paradigm or that structure, and the reason you're feeling like this all fit your daughter is because she has an illness. It's not a characterological problem. And illnesses have common symptoms. Everybody that's diabetic has common, they're all different people, but they have the same symptoms.
Well, it's ironic that you say that, because she is also a type 1 diabetic and has been since the age of 10. And when you
using that piece in her eating disorder.
Absolutely, and not only, when you brought up the question of what predated what, was that a clear marker for me? Yes, they began to, pardon the pun, they fed off of each other, and to where this downward spiral really got a hold of her in a really rough way.
Yeah. The good news is that when she's ready or had enough, there is a way out of the woods, and what's important is not stopping, it's staying stopped.
Okay. Well, she fortunately she is ready, and I can tell you that when mom and I suggested to her that she leave campus for 8 weeks, I can tell you that she was absolutely not ready, but she did it because she was pretty much told that's the only way it's going to happen. I can tell you that she wants to see success. She wants to taste victory over this illness, and I think that when she wraps up this current school year, that we're absolutely going to be looking for some way to attend your model of therapy, so that we can give her that strong leg up.
In the meantime, my suggestion is if you call that number or you write to me, I'll give you the book. You could download it and give it to her, or she can ask whatever. It's just going to reinforce what we talked about today. So if it resonates with her, it'll be helpful.
Terrific. I will do that. I don't remember seeing your email address, and it was probably there, and I just missed it, within the presentation. I see the phone number.
Yeah, I may have missed that. I'm not.
Unless it's everyforall.com.
No, that's not it.
Okay.
It's just M Lerner, LERNER, first initial M as in Marty, and
right.
Then it's at milestonesprogram.org.
Got it.
So yeah, happy to send it to you and your daughter.
Thank you. I'll have an email out to you here before the end of the day.
Right.
And we'll take the last question in the queue.
Hi, my name is Gary, and again, like the others have said, thanks for a terrific presentation. And I have three questions. I know we're out of time, so I'll try to make them brief. But on the percentages of dual diagnosis, that listing you had, those percentages were eating disorder plus one. And so I'm curious about numbers that speak to those who have eating disorder plus two or three or four, have a chemical dependency, bipolar, bulimia, trauma history, and personality disorder. That makeup is not itself uncommon either. And so I wonder about that. And then the second piece of that same question is, were those percentages of people among all levels of care, outpatient to higher, or do you find in the higher levels of care those percentages are even greater?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me, first response. There's such a range in the research when you get into demographics, because in mental health everything is self-report. So you see these ranges, and they're best guess estimates. So anecdotally, in this environment, those percentages are a little bit higher at this level of care in this particular facility. So the acuity level with the eating disorder plus one is higher than it may be in another facility. So we attract people, for instance, that do have coexisting chemical dependency or abuse issues more than maybe another center, because we're an addictions model. So we see a lot of referrals from rehabs that are treating addictions with women who all of a sudden they found out their eating disorder takes center stage because they stopped drinking or using cocaine. Your second question is, no one knows. All I can tell you is that that addictions in general are not usually solitary. And so what we know is a lot of people suffer from A, cross addictions, and B, almost all of those also have mood disorders, and C, you're really looking at, I think, a very high percentage that are tri-diagnosed. So it's hard to rely on the numbers. My answer would be too many of them.
Yeah, no, I think anecdotally myself, I would agree that many, you could say, assume, have eating disorder plus everything else or almost everything or three or more. So given that that's the case and given that's the assumption, the second part of my question really has to do with how to treat that. And I know that you're coming from the addiction model, but given that each of the disorders, say, might be at a different stage of change or a different stage of treatment or a different stage of recovery requiring different kinds of strategies, how does that inform or how does that design your assessment, your treatment planning, and your programming to address all of that at once?
Right.
On your chart of blended model, it bullet pointed treatment of multiple issues, but it seems like our treatment environment out there, we've got eating disorder facilities, we've got mental health and substance abuse all in silos, but if we have a lot of people that have everything, who's doing it the best and how are they doing it the best?
Yeah, and when you get into evidence-based treatment and whatnot and outcome studies, they're highly variable. But let me just say this. You don't have a year to treat people. So if you have a 30-day window, you're lucky, or a 60-day window, or, something of that sort. But even with a 60-day window, what you're looking to do is get someone to build a foundation where they're not engaged in harmful behavior, binging, purging, restricting. And then the second tier is to try and, during that time, find the right approach, at least, maybe it's medication-wise in part, maybe it's DBT or harm reduction part, but just start the foundation. But the real treatment, if you want to look at that way, really lies long-term, not in a residential or inpatient facility. It probably rests with what this person is doing over an elongated period of time, either in therapy, working with a dietitian, going to support groups. Rehab for an alcoholic is good, for instance, to get them to stop drinking and physically get them on firmer ground. But their recovery, in my opinion, it's just my opinion, is contingent on their participation in a relevant support group like AA. They're not going to stay in rehab forever. And I don't think it's much different with eating disorders. I'm not here to teach people to be dependent on an institution. We're trying to get them, and I understand what you're saying, we're trying to get them in a position where they can benefit from therapy. But it takes time. I mean, we're dealing with much more.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. It is it does take a lot of supports and a lot of treatment. I was just curious how we, you know, the consumer might be best able to evaluate a potential program who does it good. I mean, like your program.
It's hard to say because people will ask me, what are your outcome studies? And I'm going to be very candid. I know Cigna's on the phone, but I'm going to tell you the truth. The truth is you can't rely on outcome studies because they're self-report. So if you're not taking a lab test, you don't have something concrete to go on. If you call people or send out a survey, the people that respond are usually people that are doing well. But the people who don't respond are not doing well. And some of the people that respond lie because there's so much shame attached with relapse. So, how, you know, the statistics in mental health are very suspect unless you're measuring something that is tangible.
Mm-hmm.
So, that said, I do the surveys because of accreditation and whatnot, but I find anecdotally people that follow up by coming to aftercare, people that call me on the phone and just ask me a question, people that do the work after they leave here or anywhere. So I would say an indirect measure is how many patients in a given program participate in alumni aftercare meetings. That's an, I would call it an unobtrusive measure. Because if they're participating, it means they're getting something out of this and they're continuing their support, treatment, or what have you. So I don't know if that answers your question, but if it were my dollar.
It does. It's very helpful. Thank you. I appreciate it. This was a great presentation.
Thank you. I appreciate the feedback.
And we have no further questions in the queue. And that, with that, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.